You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, November 6, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. No longer in the literal, never having been in the metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, but instead only steps away from the Shirley H. Chisholm State Office Building.
It's a bit long.
Yeah, working on it.
It's also the first two-tape show from the office.
Yes, not terribly exciting.
I'm excited.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are now post-move and knee-deep in setting up the new office to optimize sound, to optimize video, to optimize the daily burdens of doing a daily show. It's hard. I was crying about this yesterday. Well, no, yesterday what I was crying about was the complete bloodbath that was the midterm elections. And we, of course, will be talking more about that as the week and the weeks and months go on. Cliff Schechter will be joining us tomorrow to talk about what happens next. And but we need, over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be taking sporadic days where we simply have to put the show together and get back into a groove. For those of us who have been listening to the program since its inception, nearly, well, almost to the day, 4 years ago, you'll recall that we had to do this from time to time back in the early days. And in some respects, we had a two-day downtime and we're back up broadcasting. So, but we're trying to optimize. We're also beginning to put together a fundraiser so that we can do this right here. But in the meantime, what we have for you today is a pre-recorded interview I did with Sanjay Rawal. I did this interview for Ring of Fire Radio a couple of weeks ago. He is the director of the film Food Chains. And it's a the film is a an amazing look at some of the people who supply us with our food. Sanjay, very well spoken guy, very smart, and I think you'll enjoy this interview about that movie. For members, then we will have a conversation I had with Gaius Publius, who writes at America Blog and at Hullabaloo. He is writing some piece based on some Howie Klein pieces that Howie Klein is writing it down with Tierney. This is Howie's beat. But about the failure of the Democratic Party's apparatus to elect new members to the Senate and to the House. And questioning whether or not there is a problem that the heads of the Senate and House Congressional Campaign Committees are more interested in controlling their caucus and having a specific type of caucus, i.e. a corporate one, as opposed to expanding their caucus so that they could take over the House and the Senate. Interesting conversation, and I think it's just the beginning of a conversation that we'll be having here on this program and is happening online. So members will get both those interviews. Freebies will get just the first one. A reminder, you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com or majority.fm and just click on become a member. It is your support that makes the free show possible. And then as a bonus, we give you extra material on a daily basis. You don't have to listen to it if you don't want to. But it's nice to know that it's always there. And if there's an interview that you're not terribly interested in, well, you listen to the funner half of the program. So that's the way we do it around here. Of course, you can also support this program by going to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Using the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off, get the Majority Report blend. And if you buy crap from Amazon, majorityreportkickback.com, just click on that Amazon link, bookmark it, use that as your Amazon link. We get a kickback. All right, folks, here's Sanjay Raul, and then we'll hear, members will hear from Gaius Publius. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. In recent years, Americans have taken a more active role in finding out where their food comes from. But there's much more to the story than simply finding out if your food contains pesticides, it's certified organic, or if it's local. A major issue that Americans often overlook is the labor practices that are involved in the production of their food. And I have documentary film director Sanjay Raul here to tell us why that's a major problem and what agricultural workers are doing to fight back. So, Sanjay, Food Chains is going to be opening nationwide in about 3 weeks or so on November 21st. You're going to be in New York, Los Angeles, Dallas, Houston, Orlando, Tampa, Phoenix, and Chicago. Incredibly impressive for a documentary. Tell us what is the film about, why you decided to make this film?
Well, the film is really inspired in large part by Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s father's work in the 60s. You know, RFK was one of the first major political figures to fight for farm worker rights, along with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. And, you know, when I did my own research into his work then, I realized that much of the work that had been accomplished in the 60s and 70s had been rolled back, that the state of farm labor in the U.S. was as horrific as it was before the great boycotts of the UFW and the support of RFK. That shocked me. In an age in this country where we're so interested in food, you know, we watch people making food on TV. It's both beautiful and crazy at the same time. There's very little interest in the hands that pick that food. And the more I researched the topic, the more I realized that the base of our supply chain, the people that pick our food in this country, are amongst the most ill-treated and worst paid in the country.
What do you think accounted for that change in the rollbacks? I mean, we've seen, of course, rollbacks across the board in terms of unionism, but was it a function of our food policy, or was it a function of our labor policy, or some type of combination?
Well, interestingly enough, the reason why a lot of the farm worker rights were rolled back, yeah, they can be traced to policy. They can be traced to the decline of organized labor in the U.S. But in the 1980s, something unique happened in the corporate sector. Something I think that's pretty agnostic, but had, you know, huge ramifications on the way farm workers are treated. Walmart and other big grocery stores began adopting the structure of buying low, very, very low prices and selling for very little margin. And as this happened, the entire supermarket industry began to really consolidate itself into a few giant players. In the 60s and 70s, there were more than 500 or 600 grocery chains. Now we can count the number of grocery chains on our hand. True, it seems like there's many different brands, but they're all owned by the same 5 to 7 corporations. When the grocery system became massively consolidated, the power shifted in the agricultural industry from farmers to grocery stores. Grocery stores began being able to set the terms all the way down the supply chain. I mean, they don't say what farm workers should be paid, but they effectively control the prices. And at the end of the day, if you're a farmer and you're negotiating with Walmart for your grocery prices, Monsanto for your seeds, Bayer and Dow for your fertilizers and chemicals, John Deere for your machinery, you're squeezed at every single possible turn, except when you're negotiating the price of labor. And because of this consolidation of these multi-billion dollar firms, the price that farm laborers are paid is dollar for dollar about the same now as they were paid in the 70s.
Wow. And so when we get a notion of who is the typical farm worker in this country, who are we talking about?
You know, these days, the majority of farm workers are undocumented immigrants from Mexico or Latin America. But, you know, farm labor has always been, the ranks of farm labor have always been filled by recent immigrants. If you think about, you know, the horrific days of slavery and the importation of low-wage or no-wage labor in the 1700s and 1800s, when African Americans were freed from slavery, many stayed on as poor farm workers. The Chinese migrations, the Japanese migrations, up to the Haitian and Jamaican migrations of the 90s, most of those people went into farm work. The fact that we now have undocumented Mexicans working in the fields, it's not a function of immigration. This country's farm labor system has always preyed on the most vulnerable people in the U.S., whether they have legal status or not. I mean, heck, slaves were considered 3/5 of a person. They didn't have legal status. It's that same continuum, that same cycle of poverty that's happening now.
I imagine, too, though, it is easier for these large farms when we talk about the only time where they are in a power dynamic, where they have the power in terms of purchasing or selling, is in relationship to these workers, that they have increased ability to exploit these workers because these workers don't have legal protections.
You're absolutely true about that, Sam. And the interesting thing that I've heard from immigration advocates and activists is that people in the U.S. who have papers, and this is really fascinating, who are here on a guest worker visa are actually more likely to be exploited than those who are here without any papers. When you're here in the U.S. with papers, you're tied to one employer. And that employer, in fact, has more ability to control your life than if you have the liberty to bounce from employer to employer. So it's a totally counterintuitive, backward system, and one that was developed in the 50s that hasn't been updated since.
That's fascinating. I don't think that it certainly wouldn't occur to me that would be that dynamic, but that as you spell it out, it makes a total sense. If you're sponsored by one specific employer, that employer has all the power in the world literally over you at that moment. Even if you're undocumented, at least you have the ability to go to the farm down the road or in the next state. But if you're here at the behest of one producer, they're going to take they have a real power over you. That's absolutely stunning. So, and before we get into, and I know that your film follows one particular group of workers from Florida and the coalition of Immokalee workers. Have I pronounced that right?
That's pretty close. It took me like a year to learn how to say it, but it rhymes with broccoli and it's pronounced Immokalee.
Okay. And before we get to the coalition of Immokalee workers, just tell me from your own personal background, you're involved in agriculture. At what point did you make the decision to engage in making a film, which is pretty tough?
You know, that's an interesting question, Sam. I grew up the son, or I still am the son, of a tomato breeder. My father, Conteiro Wall, worked for Del Monte in California in the 80s. And I spent summers in the field in the Central Valley, you know, basically riding my bike through tomato patches. At the same time, I moved to New York City from Berkeley to study with an Indian spiritual teacher, Sri Chinmoy. And he encouraged me to do human rights work all around the world. And when I read a book by Barry Esterbrook called Tomato Land, I realized that all the things I dedicated my life to, kind of an inner pursuit of gratitude and goodness, as well as, you know, pursuit of truth and helping people to achieve justice, I realized that despite the knowledge I thought I had about the agricultural industry, I had no idea about labor in the U.S. So when I read Barry's book, I went to Florida and began researching the roots of exploitation and the stories that he exposed in that book.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and more on this film Food Chains, which opens up on November 21st in major cities around the country. We'll be right back with Sanjay Rawal in just a moment. We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Sanjay Rawal, director of the new documentary Food Chains, about the labor abuses that are taking place in the production of American foods. So Sanjay, when we broke, you were telling us not only why you personally were drawn to this story of where our food comes from, or how, I guess, it gets to our tables in this country, and the incredible history of abuse, frankly, that our farm workers take on a daily basis, and why that dynamic exists. You chose the Immokalee workers, Immokalee workers from southern Florida. Tell us about them and what they what their life is basically like.
The amazing thing, Sam, is that the fields of Florida have historically been the grounds for a lot of abuses. From the days of slavery to the citrus fields of the 50s and 60s and 70s in central Florida. But now I have to say, what's going on in southern Florida is probably the most progressive thing in labor that's happening in the entire United States. And in fact, Stephen Greenhouse in the New York Times attested to that fact, or to, you know, corroborated that opinion in a front page article that he wrote in the Times in April of 2014. The CIW, as farm workers, tomato pickers, understood that they could no longer go to farms, to farmers directly, for wage and human rights concessions. There wasn't just enough economic space.
Let me just reiterate, because we spoke about this before the break, but that's because these farmers, they're in a power dynamic with their buyers now because of the concentration of supermarkets around the country, that they have very little room to determine the price of anything but for labor, because they are basically powerless when it comes to the prices that are set by their buyers, I guess.
Exactly. So the CIW began protesting the large buyers of tomatoes, namely fast food restaurants and supermarkets, and they asked the supermarkets and fast food restaurants for two simple things. Number one, to pay an extra penny, just 1 cent extra per pound of tomatoes that they buy from Florida, which in fact would double the wages of workers. I mean, workers only earn about a penny for every pound they pick. But more importantly, they demanded that these large retailers enforce a code of conduct that basically guaranteed the human rights of workers in the field. So what we have now in Florida is an absolutely unprecedented partnership between farmers and farm workers to work with the largest retailers in the world to ensure that the tomatoes that are picked in Florida are done so humanely and that the workers are being paid fairly. It's absolutely amazing. And it's a testament not just to the CIW, to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, but to a number of very forward-thinking farmers in Florida that enough is enough. I mean, let's end the exploitation by bringing workers to the table.
How did that come about? I mean, that's an amazing realization that the weakness here. I mean, because this is what it's all about, right? When you're involved in any type of political fight, the question is where will pressure sort of have the most impact? And the farm workers came to realize that they were basically trying to get blood from a stone. That the blood, it was basically with these markets. So how did it happen? I mean, how did this relationship, this partnership between farmers and their workers come about? I mean, how did they have this realization that the weak point was going to be the supermarkets, because then you could also involve the public in this?
That's a great point. The CIW actually began protesting against Taco Bell because of, you know, the kind of negative association of the Mexican Chihuahua with Latino pride. And a number of college campuses began boycotting Taco Bell and getting them kicked off of college campuses. And that made Taco Bell listen. Taco Bell came to the table when they saw that their main demographic, the consumers of the 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. meal or whatever they call it, began agitating. At the same time, one particular farmer in Florida named John S. Forms, one of the largest tomato farmers in the world, realized that, you know, in order for his business to kind of be brought into the 21st century, he needed to take the rights of workers seriously. And he needed to take the rights seriously by involving workers in the decisions that he was making. So there were two things happening kind of at the same time, which eventually became this wonderful program that they called the Fair Food Program. And in fact, the CIW just launched a label, which is now being featured in Whole Foods stores, particularly in the Southeast, that guarantees that the tomatoes in those stores were picked fairly and under just conditions.
To what extent has social media played a role in this sort of new dynamic? Because it occurs to me that we're seeing this more and more. You know, you have corporations which are risk averse. They don't want to do something that would offend their customer base. And it seems to me that social media, the one area where social media, its impact, it seems to be unequivocal, is in reaching the customer base of a corporation.
You're absolutely right on that. You know, the CIW and their student allies have used social media to raise awareness. But one of the interesting things, and the things that I like, and I think you like too, Sam, is that they've taken their fight offline. They actively encourage people whose awareness has been raised to go to stores and deliver letters and participate in good old outdoor community organizing. And that, coupled with the social media campaigns, have really made it clear to these large corporations that it's not just somebody clicking a button at a computer desk, but the people that click those buttons are willing to actually, like, lace up their boots and go out and take their fight to the street.
Where are we in terms of, how much success has, or where are the areas where, I guess, the CIW is continuing to knock on the doors of supermarkets?
So Bobby Kennedy and his sister, Carrie, have been steadfast in their support of the CIW and their fight against two large retailers in particular. One is Publix, a gigantic grocery conglomerate in the southeast of the U.S., and the other is Wendy's, the fast food chain, which is really the only fast food chain that hasn't signed on to this program, and they're adamant in their ignorance. So both Bobby and Carrie have led protests to help the CIW raise awareness amongst consumers that not everybody's signed on yet. I mean, the CIW have gotten Walmart, they've gotten Whole Foods, they've gotten Trader Joe's. But gigantic chains like Kroger, Safeway, Publix, you know, they haven't even begun discussions with the CIW. And that's wrong. In an era when, you know, grocery stores are trying to be as transparent as possible, particularly with how the food is grown, whether it's organic, what kind of pesticides are sprayed, so on and so forth, they have a refusal to be transparent about the conditions of the workers that pick that food.
All right. So, let me ask you, Sanjay. So, where have you seen any evidence of this sort of new organizing or this strategy, I guess, being picked up by other farm workers in different unions or even in other industries?
Well, that's a great point. You know, the interesting thing is that there's a very well-known group called the Workers' Rights Consortium based out of Washington, D.C., a guy named Scott Nova runs it. And they helped the CIW in their early days planning this agreement that they would have corporations sign. And each time the company had signed on, that agreement was updated. So when the horrific fires happened in Bangladesh, the Workers' Rights Consortium actually worked with the CIW to develop a similar program that would be put to use in the Bangladesh garment industry. And that agreement was signed by H&M and by Zara, two European retailers. So we're seeing this kind of brand-focused activism, you know, that circumvents legislation, something that can be changed every time a new set of representatives gets elected in. This corporate brand-level activism is now beginning to be replicated, not just by workers in the U.S., but by workers globally.
Fascinating stuff. The film is Food Chains, The Revolution in America's Fields. It is opening in New York, L.A., Dallas, Houston, Orlando, Tampa, Phoenix, and Chicago on November 21st of this year. And, of course, you can go to foodchainsfilm.com for more information. Sanjay, Raul, thank you so much for your time today.
Sam, you're the best. I'm a longtime fan, and it's been an honor.
Congratulations on your work. Very impressive. Sanjay Raul is the director of the new film Food Chains, The Revolution in American Fields.
Say it's an apple pie.